That panel, if they could please come to the stage, is Mark Ratcliffe, who we all know well as the Chief Executive of Chorus, Matt Crockett, the Chief Executive of Telecom Wholesale, Jamie Badley from Internet NZ, Rod Inglis is representing Woosh Wireless in place of Andrew McPherson, and Mark Petrie from Snap Internet. Could you please welcome our very esteemed panellists? Two really interesting but potentially different takes on the open access scenario there. Does anyone want to sort of open up on the question as to whether open access is a commercial proposition or just something people do because they're forced to? Matt? Your territory.
Do I need to push this or...?
Mr. Music, is it working?
Is that coming up?
You can see I'm a Rumpelram boy. I still call him Mr. Music there, Matt.
Yeah, I think you know, one of the good things out of the presentations here is that there's many different flavours of open access, and I certainly think that open access is already deeply a part of the mix. I mean, certainly I think that telecom's already got a lot of open access, both across fibre and across copper. Yes, we don't have passive layered dark fibre at this point. But I do think that there's certainly the right things to be debating. I think also what's good to see coming through in the presentations is you can't look at open access in isolation of other factors, including return on investment, pricing, and a whole raft of other features. And that's why, you know, it's the right stuff to be debating and looking at. And I don't think there's any one right model. We've seen that. But if you get it wrong, you can really, I think, stuff up the investment or the way in which it's used. So, you know, I don't think it's a frivolous topic. I think it's an important topic, but it's lots of dimensions to the debate.
Sorry, did someone else have a comment they wished to make?
One of the things I enjoyed about the first presentation is just looking at the different models that were available, and I was particularly interested in the municipal open access model. The thing that strikes me around New Zealand is there's various assets of different forms owned, managed by different operators, be they ducts, poles, that sort of thing. And for me, you know, that's leveraging those pre-existing assets, old gas ducts, electricity ducts, is a useful thing to do, because if we want to achieve outcomes quickly, in terms of, you know, high-performance broadband, we also need to be cognizant of the impact on the public about rolling these things out. So to use what we've got as effectively as possible is important. So, yeah, that's my initial thoughts.
Okay. Mark, just a dumb question, because I'm not actually all that au fait with what's been going on over here lately. The you sell your network to people, so all the aspects of your network. But Matt was just saying you don't offer a dark fibre, but you'll offer that to. You must own dark fibre, and you must sell it to Telecom. But you don't sell it to anyone else.
No, that's right. We sell fibre services,
right,
to people, but not dark fibre.
Right. Okay. So you light it yourself.
Well, actually, the telecom group lights it because I don't have any electronics in my part of the business.
Okay.
So we have
open access at the active layer, built within the undertakings, and, you know, we've already started this at least in a trial capacity with new subdivisions. We're providing equivalents of inputs, fibre to the home, at a layer 2 active, but that's supplied from wholesale to any service provider who wants that.
So as a Chorus access seeker, will that be something you're applying to Chorus as an access seeker to buy that product or to buy that passive layer to build your products?
Let's be clear that in the undertakings there is no obligation for Chorus to provide dark fibre to anyone. We are signed up to an obligation to provide EOI active layer fibre to the home. You know, so I think that's where, as I said, there's many different models, but for clarity, you know, that is not something that we do today.
Yeah, I was just getting clarity for myself, and I do, you know, want to not sort of tread on any particular toes because I'm too good at doing that. Look, I'm keen to sort of let other people talk because I've done a lot of talking. So but do we have any other questions you want to sort of throw at this panel or just leave it to me to question? Can we give you, we'll hold you in reserve for a little while, Tex, is that all right? Merv, and look, I feel like a school teacher. Not all the same hands, please. Can we see some new participants as well?
I just want to start the ball rolling. We've got an interesting mixture up there in the panel, which might be able to give me an answer to this one. Within 5 years, are we actually going to get this fibre to the home, what the consumers expect? If not, why not?
Are you referring to the government's fibre to the home?
I'm talking about fibre to the home, regardless of whether it's the government, whether it's the telcos, whoever.
Well, I don't think anyone at this table has actually volunteered to do fibre to the home yet, have they? They're only...
We're doing some fibre to the home today.
Yeah.
We've been rolling fibre to homes for over 15 years in telecom, and there are relatively few services working over it, but it exists in the ground. There's 22,000 kilometres worth of fibre in New Zealand here, but there's relatively little take-up of it in terms of homes. So I think it's quite clear from what the government says is they are going to ensure that this country has fibre to the home, either by them doing stuff to activate it or making sure the industry sends up. So I think it's a given that it's going to be here. It's just a case of how much and how quickly.
Right. Anyone else want to contribute to that, or you're leaving it to Mr. Corus? Okay.
Shane Hobson, Velocity Networks. If you do have so much fibre to homes, what do you see are the barriers to uptake?
Yeah, I'll talk to that. I think, firstly, we don't have all of the scale products ready for that in terms of the open access product. So at the moment we're in a trial period on that with our partner World Exchange. We are in discussion with other players around extending that trial. So one of them is actually having the product available. And I will add though that other players other than Telecom have deployed fibre to subdivisions, are not wholesaling it at all. So that's one thing, but probably an even bigger one is that, and this is something that we really need to keep an eye on as an industry and as a community, is the, you know, not all of the services and the capabilities at the service provider layer are there to be able to take this and actually do something with it. Now, I think the capabilities are there, but have they all come together yet? No. And so I think there's still a lot of work to do around stuff that's already been deployed to be able to really take advantage of it in terms of the, you know, everything, you know, everything through to the CPE, the applications and other things. So that's partly, as I said, we're in a pilot phase at the moment to learn from it, to make sure that we're optimising across all those various pieces of it so it's a good end user experience.
Does anyone else?
I think listening to Bob's talk and his recommendation of continuing on with the usage charge is a little dangerous. I think inevitably with usage-based charges, consumers end up being conservative how they use the internet. And inevitably, under his model where you've got multiple new, exciting new services coming over the internet or over the one-pipe model, people just won't use them because every time they do use them, it'll cost them more and more. And there's a variability associated with using, which is something that you should have incentives for use, not disincentives for use.
Okay. That's an interesting view. I mean, it's clearly one we've experienced with the internet because people, it's not like the tap. You can't see the water running out of it.
I think one of the other things that we've got to focus on as well is, as Paul Clarkin from World Exchange mentioned, a large part of the cost structure in delivering internet services is international capacity. Now, the only way that we're actually going to turn that around is somehow reduce our reliance on that international capacity. The only obvious thing to do is to try and ensure that we've got services, content, information localised in New Zealand. Every minute that you spend looking at a locally sourced application is a minute you don't spend looking at an internationally sourced one. And I think we need to provide a lot more focus in our own capability within New Zealand, so we're getting that content here.
Yeah, as Murray Milner delightfully put it, you need to all talk Maori and that'll solve that problem. Look, just wanted to pick up on a comment that Matt made just there, because it's one of the other interesting things about the whole NGN discussion, just the wider question of how would you lead the world in NGN development. We do tend to get into this habit of focusing on the open access to the access technologies that might be deployed by an incumbent, as opposed to the open access to the access technologies that are deployed by others, be that others doing fibre or even indeed wireless. That's the piece that I find particularly interesting in Benoit's piece, which is that open access should be a business opportunity for everybody, not just for necessarily incumbent. So Matt, as an example, why do you think other people aren't doing open access, since it seems to be commercially desirable activity?
I think at the heart of it comes back to some of those challenges around business model and pricing. You know, you could see there that, you know, the model that has traditionally been the way telcos approached it has been part of how you have an overall decent return is that you hang on to yourself and you actually get a return on some of the other parts of that value chain. Now, moving away from that is a dislocation that's hard to grapple with, particularly when there's uncertainty on the pricing. You know, and I think that's part of what, you know, I think we would collectively grapple with the passive layer, which is, well, how do you price it? And if you get it wrong, then you completely stuff up all of the incentive to ever deploy it in the first place. So I think that, you know, I think it's a business model thing and a philosophy thing.
And an uncertainty thing. Okay, look, I'm going to go to the... Unless someone else wanted to contribute, because I was interested in Woosh's view about, you know, do you think open access and wireless is a good idea?
Well, I think it is. I think that, you know, we obviously agree with the view on termination that we've heard voiced through the conference, and that is a form of access to other networks. So we think in the wireless space there is room for open access. Sorry, can you hear me? Yeah, we think in wireless there is room for open access, and we also think that we'll see more and more hybrid networks, which are a mix of wireless, fibre and other delivery methods. So I think from what we've heard in this conference, open access sounds like almost an inevitability, and to be a player in the industry, I think we've just got to face up as to... you know, how it's going to happen and how we can survive in that space to make money and get a return on investment for shareholders and deliver good services to customers.
Can I add
so things across the board?
I think one of the dangerous areas around open access with wireless is comparative to fibre-based technologies, the technological development associated with wireless platforms is much more rapid, and it can yield a better result in terms of performance over a short space of time. You put fibre in the ground, it's always going to be there. If you open access a wireless delivery platform and you treat that as a universal delivery mechanism, you're pretty much locked into that technology for a fairly long period of time. So I would caution unabated open access to wireless delivery platforms, but what I would perhaps focus on is Hilltops. Spectrum is relatively well managed through MED. That's, you know, for all intents and purposes open access, but from my observations I don't see strategic assets such as our, you know, key hilltops and mountains around the country as truly open access.
Right. You know, I think it's good. That's a good point, but just in the wireless space in general, I think there's less need for intervention because there already is duplication. There's three wireless networks out there, either built or four in the process of being built. So there's competitions emerging, and I think it's sort of taken care of itself. But I think it's the way
from a national perspective, but on a regional basis.
We still tend to think in terms of, and this is just, you know, a piece sort of from the conference as a whole. We tend to think in terms of
of voice services or access to the internet, and you'd sit there saying, well, okay, I can choose my mobile provider from amongst three and I can get my voice service on my broadband. But as we get into these more interesting new innovative services that I might want to be, or I might be Snap Internet wanting to provide, where I need people to be able to access my service from a mobile environment and a fixed environment, we seem to have a lot of focus on how I'd be able to get that open access to the fixed network. But I'm still confronted by the fact that you know, there's not actually a desire for an open access to the mobile environment to allow me to genuinely innovate and do what Benoit suggested, which is grow the pie by having innovation and things that drive take-up. And it seems to me that there's a real dichotomy that potentially could be that might need to be addressed, in the sense we tend to focus on the NGN as a fixed issue rather than the NGN as a network issue. That's all.
Well, if I can just comment on that, I think in the wireless space, as I said, if there's multiple networks, it's the way those networks are going to talk to each other that's important. So, and that really gets down to termination, roaming and things like that. So customers will have choices in the wireless space, and provided that the cost structure between the challengers and the new entrants isn't prohibitive and there aren't blocking methods by the incumbents, I think that, you know, as long as those few crossover points can be managed by the regulator, then there'll be a good vibrant market that'll see good growth and good or new services being provided to customers. So it'll, okay. I think it'll be a good environment.
Okay. We had a question
just
there?
Interesting on the... sorry.
Mean, for
Corey. As somebody who's almost exclusively got fixed assets, one of the biggest drivers for growth in our network at the moment is mobile players wanting fibre,
yeah,
in order that they can provide their services. So we are rolling fibre and, for some people, rolling an awful lot of copper to their sites to provide the mobile speeds that they need, because it's mobile is getting a more localised service. So I mean, it's a big, big driver of fixed networks is the mobile business itself.
I've got a question in the back, and Benoit looks like he wants to say something. Is that right?
Just to help set a bit of the scene.
Can you stand up, please?
Sure, sorry.
And
Rob Spray, I think all of you know me one way or another. Just to set the scene a little bit, what's each of your positions on public investment into this infrastructure, either in public-private partnership or in whatever model? It'd just be really interesting to walk through the panel and get an individual opinion on public investment in infrastructure.
Well, I'd like to start on that. I think there should be a mixture. I think if you're focusing on a rollout in a short period of time, there has to be an involvement from the public in this thing. And I think adding further to that, I think local support within regions from the public sector is also a good thing. I just think it'll end up being a lot more straightforward.
Anyone else?
Yeah, I think it's a terrific idea. I think there are large parts of New Zealand where nobody who's looking for an economic return is going to go and invest money in taking fast broadband to there. There's at least 14% of the country that's never going to get what I think was referred to as proper fast broadband or something along there. That is an obvious place for public money to go, given that's largely where the New Zealand economy is based.
Your minister seems to be indicating he's going to spend his money in a different 75% of the country, Mark.
The question is, do you agree with the minister? I thought we were asked for an opinion.
Someone else?
The way I'd put it, I think, is if the government believes that there's a national business case, because I thought it was quite laid out well in Bob's thing, which is if there's a return there from a public and they would like to invest, then we absolutely welcome it and want to do everything to work with them and the rest of the industry to achieve those public aims. I think Paul Reynolds has been very clear that Telecom doesn't want to profit from the government money, that we want to just make sure that benefit goes to the end users and ultimately to the now, if we put our own money in matching that, then of course we're going to look for a return on that. Because it will be our capital, but if it's the government's capital, then we don't intend to profit off it. So given that, I think the minister's made it clear they believe there's a national business case, and we're absolutely happy to work with them on it.
And yeah?
Yeah, I think you have to be pragmatic about it. The government's made their decision. They was very clear yesterday that they're going ahead with it, so it's a fait accompli. So once that happens, then you say, what does that mean? And I think what it means is that there'll have to be regulated services at the access level, and it seems like it's going to be at the passive access level, looking at a lot of these presentations, because otherwise we have to accept a situation where the government will be subsidising an element of the industry, and it seems that unless there's some sort of regulatory control over that aspect, you'll get an unfair outcome. So I guess that's a task for the Commerce Commission to work through with the government to just determine what's going to be a fair pricing regime.
Matt and Mark, do you think it's...
Yeah, we have a great example in Christchurch, actually, where we have Christchurch City Networks. It's a public-private partnership. We've rolled out gigabit access to many, many customers. We do have an issue, sort of to hark back to the dark fibre again, where there is, and it was in the last speech, a lot of duplication of the network, where there are alternate network providers, of course, who already have existing infrastructure that we're unable to access. And we're finding that that CCNL has to basically duplicate their access over top of it, which does seem to be an inefficient way of doing things, especially in this current climate.
When we talked about passive network elements, I don't know enough about New Zealand. Do you have an access regime to ducts or not?
What is it?
Do you have an access regime to ducts?
No. There's no regulated...
No.
Okay. Well, it's a completely different part of our regulation. It's actually regarded as part of the environmental regulation in Australia, not part of the competition regulation.
I will say, just to the point that Rod made, that, you know, I don't think it's a fait accompli at all that it means that it needs to be open access at the passive layer. I think one of the things that the last two presentations brought to life is actually that there's many different models, and that's only one of them. So I don't think we should prejudge that personally, because at the end of the day, I think it has to cover all the bases, including obviously the pricing, including the economic model, etc. And I think we should keep our mind open to many different things as we engage on this, and not jump to that conclusion off the bat.
And depending on the pre-existing assets in the ground around the place in New Zealand, you may end up having a combination of different models in different areas.
Yeah, correct.
Right.
Correct.
You know, some places it makes sense, like Gisborne, to have passive access. Other places, the only sensible thing to do is have an open access metro Ethernet network.
So why does Gisborne make sense to have passive access? What's different about Gisborne?
I understand the infrastructure in Gisborne has been laying dark fibre for years and years, waiting for someone to turn up.
Right. Okay. Benoit, you wanted to contribute again.
I just had a short question, but I think if it's okay, I'll comment on that last exchange as well. My question was for Mark. Why the hell do you roll out copper? I mean, shouldn't rolling out copper be absolutely banned?
No, because there's such a high demand for it, because most of the rest of the stack is built off copper-based services.
So at the aggregation level, you have to deploy copper because you can't.
Because that's
deal
what
with fiber.
I mean. That's really what, despite all the rhetoric, that's what most of our customers want us.
Sure, but what I mean is, if you're going to dig, you might as well put a future-proof.
Yeah, just for clarity on new subdivisions, and I don't know how many years it's been, Mark, but we haven't laid copper to new subdivisions for at least a couple of years.
Not for decent-sized ones, no. But for small ones, yes, we do, because otherwise the people in those subdivisions wouldn't get services, because there aren't you can't just roll fibre out and have... They can't go to a service provider to provide
services. The rest
service
of the network is not in line with that, or is it the rest of the ecosystem?
Yeah, it's not lined up with the fibre-based... access layer.
So in those cases when a subdivision's opening up and you're rolling fibre in there, is that exclusively your fibre, or can other companies...
No, I think the basic happens is if it's a developer will ask the people to tender for the right to lay stuff into that subdivision. We and other people will get the right to do it. In our case, if the subdivision's big enough, we'll lay fibre and copper in there. If it's not, it's not big enough, we'll just lay copper in there. Other people will lay whatever they lay. I mean, in Telstra Clear's case, John, what do you lay? I can't remember. Both.
I guess the other point I wanted to make was about this passive versus active. I think there's a good case for an active level access product for two reasons. The first is that no matter how much potentially telecom would like that not to happen, there will be other networks than their own, and they will be deployed using different engineering rules, different equipment, different topologies. And if you want to have a homogeneous national access for the service layer over these heterogeneous networks, it can only happen on the active layer. The second argument is the point I was trying to make in my presentation, which is that, and I agree with what you said, that if you only have one revenue stream on the wholesale layer, it's not a very compelling case. But I think on the active layer, you can have multiple service revenues on the wholesale layer, because typically, if you provide a healthcare service, that's going to have an SLA attached to it, et cetera. And that justifies that the wholesale provider would build a wholesale product specifically for critical services. And therefore, potentially, you multiply the sources of revenue, which might or might not, you know, mean that you don't have to have variable pricing. I guess I'm still on the fence on that one. But at least I think it's a more virtuous wholesale model than saying, if you have one customer, you're only ever going to get whatever it is, $15 for that customer per month, full stop.
Okay. Did you anyone want to respond to that, or are you happy with that?
No, I think I'd just say, you know, speaking from a telecom wholesale perspective, we're absolutely up for all kinds of innovation on layer two active services for different customer segments, and bring it on. It's good business.
Let's talk.
So can I just see hands in the air of people who wish to ask questions? Can I take the one over the back there first, then this one, then we'll come back to... Where was Tex? He's gone. Oh, no, it was Tex there. Okay, then Peter.
David Butcher again from Wellington. Just slightly before its untimely demise, Berenstain's telecommunications division published a report saying that if Europe engaged in structural separation, they would release about €123 billion of value in Europe. I noticed that aspect of it was not covered by either Benoit or Bob, and I was just wondering if they or any of the panel, A, are aware of the report, or B, have any comment on the impact of that on the potential value of the networks. Thank you.
Well, who wants to comment on the potential unlocking of value from structural separation?
Haven't seen the report, but I think Telecom's position on structural separation is well known to the New Zealanders in the room.
Anyone else? One could make the facetious comment, which would be Berenstain's obviously got something else wrong, so... Bob or Benoit? No comment? Okay, well... Oh, no, Benoit does wish to participate in that one. Doesn't surprise me. Read it all about in fibreevolution.com tomorrow. I want to get more of that advertising revenue.
I think the thing with structural separation is it's still very largely a theoretical model, and I think it's a theoretical model that may look good on paper, but it's kind of hard to evaluate the actual impacts until it's actually implemented somewhere. I certainly think that looking at it from an outside point of view, structural separation potentially makes more sense than functional separation, but some of the external impacts of that separation, I'm not sure we can really assess today. And, you know, notwithstanding the evidence skill of these people at Berenstain's, but...
There? Texas? Yeah.
Sorry. I understand I'm between everybody in the bar, so I'll be brief. Is there any discussion from the panelists on whether ownership separation would help ownership open access better? Given the government's investment plans, that's my first question, and it's thematic with the previous observation. And Earlier in the day, just making a comment and another question, we had a very constructive explanation from Telecom's Tristan Gilbinson explaining that there's a new regulatory environment and Telecom's behaviour would change, and that with a new CEO and new regulatory environment, it's unlikely pocket pricing would occur. Is it possible that the Telecom wholesale CEO could just explain that peculiar article in The Independent which suggested that Telecom wholesale was pocket pricing Vodafone's DSLAM network in Auckland, and just what impact that might have on open access? Thank you.
Would you like me to start with that one, Tex? Look, all I'll say, Tex, is that, you know, from where I sit, I thought part of the objective of local loop unbundling was to stimulate more infrastructure-based competition. There is infrastructure-based competition at wholesale, and telecom wholesalers competing. Isn't that what was meant to happen?
Well. Matt wasn't here, so that's reasonable. That's reasonable for Matt to simply say he's doing what he thinks is the right thing. You might need to write Tristan a question later on, or any of the horde of telecom lawyers over here who could answer it later. Many of whom are my friends.
Or former telecom lawyers.
and actually former AAPT lawyers on Sir Common. There was a first part of that question as well, wasn't there?
The next one is the panelists' comment on whether ownership situation would be more constructive for open access and might governments opposed broadband systems.
So it's a structural separation from the point of view of achieving the government's objective of deployment as opposed to structural separation from the point of view of creating shareholder value. Any comment?
Well, I think unless I missed it, I don't think the minister declared his hand yesterday, did he? I think he just said he's talking to people about a range of options.
Can I suggest that Mark is about to answer Telecom's position on structural separation is well known?
Yes.
I think Benoit hit the nail on the head, which is it's appealing on paper, but I think the pragmatics, particularly when you're in the middle of quite a complex mid-flight operational separation, you know, are non-trivial, and they need to be taken into consideration is all I'd say.
Although I do note that there's other network providers out there that are demonstrating pretty effective structural separation by, you know, providing different services and different niche areas.
Do you want to give us an example of that?
Oh, case in point being the various different metro access providers around the country.
Right.
Working with different, you know, other different providers.
Okay.
So, you know, it's really structural separation in action.
Now, I'm just trying to figure out what I've got, because I've got Peter on the list. Who are you pointing to? Can you wave a hand in the air?
Just a quick comment on that, if I can make it. I think there's one argument for structural separation in the context of this NGN discussion, which is that as a telco, you can't tap into long-term funding. Your shareholders expect you to get 3 to 5 year returns. Maybe you can push up to 6 or 7, but that's about it. As an infrastructure company, you can tap into funds that are willing to fund bridges and highways and would be happy with 15 to 20 year returns. That's the only point I'm going to make.
Okay. Now we'll go to Peter Downing at the back. If you can run the microphone back there. You're doing a wonderful job.
Thanks.
Because I'm sending you backwards and forwards at the rate of knots. And then we'll come over to the gentleman on my right. Yep, Peter?
Thank you.
Stand up, please. I know it's bad for your back, but they can't see you out there in webcast land.
Okay. It's Peter Darling again from Ponderosa Communications. In the two presentations that started before the panel session, we heard different points of view. We talked about passive and active open access. And then in Bob James, he talked largely about the question of a utility. The question, I guess, that comes is, are we going to have all of these in New Zealand, or is there going to be some decision on some basis for there? Is there any case for national consensus on the direction? Because if you look at all the options that Benoit talked about, for example, all of them have attractions. and we've got to take into account, as I questioned before, the possibility of 3G and 4G at LTE and so on. It seems to me that what we're doing is diverging rather than converging at all. I was just wondering if it is possible to converge rather than diverge at this stage in the presentation. And be very interested to hear what the people on the platform say, and also from Bob and Benoit.
So, panellists, did you get that?
I think so.
Okay. You going to start, Mark?
No, I thought Jamie could. I think he said, I think so. But
go, Jamie.
I'll go second.
Yeah, there's an element where, you know, it's appealing to have the one united approach to rule them all, where it was one model that works absolutely everywhere. I think if our ability to recover out of a recession demonstrates our long-term strength, then the speed and flexibility with how you execute things is important. Trying to develop an absolutely homogenised national framework will take time and it will be hard. And I think Kiwis need to be flexible enough and adaptable enough to come up with the right solution over certain areas. I don't think that a national unifying approach is going to work. I think you're going to have to look at more regionalised approaches in some way. Again, leveraging the assets that are there to achieve the outcome as effectively and efficiently and pragmatically as you possibly can.
Anyone else? No?
Yeah, I think it's sort of different beliefs. I think there's a group of people who would believe that a lot of regulation and frameworks enables people to do things more quickly and everybody gets a go. And there's a group of people who think that the less regulation and frameworks and the more that market forces are allowed to take precedence, the more flexibility the country has. And I think we've got those two things alive and well in New Zealand at all the times. We've as a country, moved from an environment where things were pretty free to an environment where they are much more regulated now than they used to be 5 years ago. And look, time will tell, I guess, whether that's going to make us flexible for the challenges that we've got to face today. And I don't know the answer whether it there. I'm just saying that we have moved to an environment now which is a lot more regulated than it was, and we'll see whether that makes us flexible or not.
Anyone else? Yeah.
Yeah, I think there's areas where the industry and the users and the community can come together and reach consensus, and I think there's probably some areas where that will never happen. I think the industry's got to just move through those and, you know, be growing up about it, and where they can reach consensus, and where they can't, they might need a little bit of help.
Okay, I'm going to need to move us on. Rob, very quickly, and then I'm going to this question here, then I'm going to start wrapping up.
I think in order to get a higher level of adoption quickly in New Zealand, there can be a big benefit in having a uniform framework. And when we look back on the history of telecommunications in Australia or New Zealand, you know, occasionally we look back and think people got the frameworks really right and things happened great. On other occasions, we think people really stuff things up. And I think mostly people aren't at all happy at the moment with any of the broadband frameworks that exist. And I'd say that's true around the world. There's no great framework model that's working just fine. And people are looking at structural separation, I think, primarily to solve a problem and to get to a different end, which is open access. And the problem is that just you know, structural separation, I guess, forces you to work out things like pricing and return on equity. But I actually think there's a more direct answer, which is to go to the pricing models and the return on equity.
Okay. Thank you, Bob. Now, one question over here, then I have one question I have to ask, and then we can move on.
It's Ray CC again. My question is to Jamie, Mark and Rod. What do you think if the gov owns the access network?
Hang on.
It's going off on. What do you think if the government owned or the people owned the core network and it was provided as an open access network to the wholesalers and the service providers at a toll rate.
And that was to, I presume, Mark Petrie, not Mark Ratcliffe. Yeah, which Mark? There's two Marks here.
Mark Petrie.
Yeah. Jamie, Mark and Ron? Rod?
I would most certainly like to see an open access network, especially on the national transport layer. As James said before, there are a lot of metropolitan networks that are growing at the moment, but there are still going to be a lot of towns that are without those networks, where there may be some other networks that exist that are under telecoms fibre ownership.
Jamie?
I think the Commerce Commission has already had a look at the national backhaul networks. They've recognised that it's competitive in many areas, and there's also areas where it's not. Where it's not competitive, perhaps, but where competition exists, so I don't think we need to further mess with that.
Okay, and Rod, do you have a view?
Well, I personally err on the side of less intervention and regulations better, except where it's obviously very necessary. But as I said before, I think we've got to be pragmatic. This is the decision's been made. So once it's been made and the government's getting involved in the industry and going to own part of significant infrastructure, then I think that it has to be some sort of regulated tolling system similar to what we've got with the lines companies in the electricity industry. Otherwise, you know, it's hard to see how everyone's going to coexist and get fair access and even-handed pricing and those sort of things. So I think once the horse is out of the stable and it's now really up to the industry to decide how that's going to work, and obviously there's a lot of issues that have yet to be worked through.
Okay, well look, I do have one last question that I wanted to ask, because in the discussion, that wasn't me, I didn't touch anything. In the discussion papers that, in the submissions in response to the NGN discussion paper, there's a lot of different definitions about open access, but one of the common themes in open access is this idea that open access is providing to others on equivalent terms to self-provision is equal to open access. And we heard yesterday about, you know, things that need to happen to create innovation in services, and we've also heard about the idea that innovation in services will actually grow the revenue streams to provide the outcomes. And I was thinking about a railway analogy, and because actually a lot of this access stuff started with railways. And if I wanted to access a train line that had been, the civil engineering works had been done for 8-car trains, you know, the stations were for 8-car trains, the passing loops were for 8-car trains. But I've got a new locomotive that can draw a 12-car train, and I've got a business case for a 12-car train. And I go to the railway provider and say, well, I want to run my 12-car train over your network. And you're going to say, well, you can't, because I don't provide access to 12-car trains, I only provide access to 8-car trains. You'd think that scenario should include the possibility that says, well, you should have a process whereby I can actually pay for the civil engineering works to upgrade it to handle a 12-car train, and that's really what open access means. Mark and Matt, have you sort of encountered those kinds of considerations yet in your definitions of your open access now about upgrade you'd make because an access seeker said, I really want something different to what you're providing?
Yes. I think the thing that you're raising is an additional dimension, because to my mind there's an equivalence dimension, there's an openness dimension, and then this is a willing to be flexible dimension, yeah, if you like. And the answer is absolutely. If a customer comes and wants a new wholesale product and, you know, we think that the business case of that stacks up to provide to them at wholesale, we'll absolutely build it. And we have those discussions all of the time. And I think the important thing under the equivalence and self-consumption thing is that, you know, if retail or Genai, in the telecom case, want a new product, they have to come and ask us about it just like everyone else does. And we consult with everyone and don't just do it for them. And they benefit when we do an innovation for another customer and vice versa. So I think it's constructive like that, but I don't really see it as an open access thing. I just think it is a are you willing to be flexible and do good commercial business thing on whatever level of openness is there. Yeah. The answer is absolutely.
Well, maybe that then is a hint for the people writing stuff about NGN that they need to write open and flexible access as opposed to just open, because it doesn't always come through. And you know, my experience of working for an incumbent telco in Australia, I always remember the day we tried to build a service for the banks for doing FPOS. We built a really good service, we just never talked to the customers first. So surprise, surprise, none of them bought it. Okay, well, unless there's another pressing question, oh, I've got one last pressing question. It's so keen. And the more time you take now, the less time I have to wrap up, which I like the idea of.
Yeah, Lance Reynolds from UBS in New Zealand. My question relates, I guess, to the Commerce Commission itself. I'm assuming that private companies won't put in CapEx until they know what the return is. My question is then, how long will it take for telecom and private companies to know what the return is? How long will that take?
Well, I'm going to answer on behalf of the Commerce Commission and say I don't know that they can answer that question, because you know, you might be talking about a regulated rate of return, but you know, they invest every day not knowing what their rate of return is going to be.
No, I don't want to know what the rate is. How long will the process take?
How long the process will take to do what?
To determine the WACC. Will it take 2 years, 3 years, 4 years?
Well, I don't think they're proposing to regulate anything in this space at the moment, so they haven't asked that question.
If it was, it's a scenario. How long would it take?
What's the scope?
Yeah. And I mean, sorry. Osmond, go answer it. Yeah, but I would leave it alone if I were you.
The only thing I wanted to mention is that the Commission, as some people will know, has been working on guidelines for WACC for some time, and we intend to finish that work fairly soon. And it won't give timelines and that sort of thing, but we'll give some pretty clear guidance on our thinking around some of the key parameters. So I think that will help people.
There you go, there's your answer. I must admit, one of the things that I've always found fascinating about some of the alternative models is if you go to new capital markets, you don't wind up with a question about what's the WACC, because the answer is whatever the new capital markets are prepared to pay provide the funds at. Ladies and gentlemen, I would like you to ask me, I'd like to ask you to join me in thanking our esteemed panellists, Mark, Rod, Matt and Jamie. And let them escape from the stage, because I now have the...